I want the American people to understand is this is not endless. It's not protracted. We're not allowing mission creep. The president has set a very specific mission to accomplish. And our job is to unrelentingly deliver that. Now, he gets to control the throttle.
There seems to be no end game. The president says that it's nearly complete, but the Department of Defense says that it's just begun. So this kind of contradictory, confusing, chaotic message the American people will continue to make this war deeply unpopular.
From the executive branch to Capitol Hill to the American people, vastly different views on American Israel's war with Iran. What is the objective and what is the end game? Critical questions as shockwaves hit the global economy. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. As military leaders continue the fight and the missiles continue to rain down, there's even disagreement about what to call this conflict. President Trump has called it both a war and a, quote, little excursion. The distinction is a legal one. If it's a war, then it could be considered illegal because under the Constitution, officially declaring war is the sole responsibility of Congress.
You just said it is a little excursion, and you said it is a war. So which one is it?
Well, it's both. It's both. It's a an excursion that will keep us out of a war, and the war is going to be, for them, it's a war. For us, it's turned out to be easier than we thought.
In the meantime, Iran has broadened its attack radius, apparently deciding its strongest strategy against America's powerful military is to turn this war into an attack on the global economy. This week, beyond threatening oil tankers from leaving the Persian Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz, Iran attacked three commercial ships in the Gulf, widening the danger for maritime cargo of all kinds. Taking the war beyond its own waters, it hit two oil tankers sheltering in the Iraqi port of Basra, forcing authorities to stop operations at all Iraq oil terminals. On Thursday, an Iranian attack sparked a major fire in Bahrain near the kingdom's international airport and in close proximity to tanks that service the kingdom's oil industry. And in Oman, Iranian drones hit fuel tanks at the port of Salalah. As firefighters struggle to contain lingering flames, all operations at the port have been paused. Analysts say Iran's strategy appears to be aimed at generating so much global economic pain that it pressures the U.S. and Israel to end the war. After the military strike on the war's first day killed Iran's supreme leader, 86-year-old Ayatollah Khamenei, President Trump insisted he should have a say in who was selected as Iran's next leader. But that is not happening. In fact, the war might have brought a younger version of the Ayatollah into power. His son, 56-year-old Mojtaba Khamenei, has been named as the new supreme leader, solidifying the Islamic hardline grip on power. The younger Khamenei is considered even more extreme than his father, and observers say he will likely keep up repressive crackdowns against Iranian dissenters. Before the announcement he would succeed his father, President Trump had called Khamenei a completely unacceptable choice. Nearly 2 weeks ago, during an Oval Office photo op, a reporter asked the president what the worst-case scenario would be in this war.
I guess the worst case would be we do this and then somebody takes over who's as bad as the previous person, right? That could happen. We don't want that to happen. That would probably be the worst. You go through this and then in 5 years you realize you put somebody in who was no better.
On Thursday, in his first message as Supreme Leader, Khamenei vowed revenge against the U.S. and Israel and said attacks on U.S. military bases in the Middle East will continue. Khamenei was injured in the strike on his father's compound and did not appear on camera. But his determination could be strong. The attack killed not only his father, but reportedly also his mother, wife, son, and sisters. The war continues to take a toll on American service members. The Pentagon acknowledged this week that about 140 military personnel were wounded in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia during the first round of Iran's retaliatory counterattacks, 8 of them severely. That's in addition to the 7 military members whose deaths were confirmed last week. And on Friday of this week, this sad news. U.S. Central Command confirmed all 6 crew members of an American KC-135 perished after a mid-air accident involving another American aircraft over Iraqi airspace. The KC-135 is an aerial refueling plane, and military experts say its operations are among the most complex of all military missions. And this update about that deadly missile strike on an elementary school in Iran that killed more than 165 people, most of them Iranian schoolgirls. Multiple news organizations are reporting a preliminary U.S. military assessment indicates the U.S. accidentally hit the school using outdated and faulty intelligence information. The school is located next to a base for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. A formal investigation is expected to take months and will include interviews with all of those involved. The bombing of the school has become a focal point of the war, and if confirmed to be at the hands of the U.S., would be among the highest civilian casualty events caused by American military operations in the last two decades. In the meantime, Iran maintains its chokehold on the Strait of Hormuz, through which 20% of the world's oil is transported. With growing concern about a possible energy crisis, the price of crude oil remained more than $100 a barrel. On Thursday, the International Energy Agency said the war has triggered the largest supply disruption in the history of the global oil market. But it is not just oil getting jammed up at the Strait of Hormuz. It's also huge amounts of nitrogen-based fertilizer, which is shipped through the strait and used by farmers around the globe, including in the U.S. Since the war began, nitrogen fertilizer prices have jumped by nearly 30%. The disruption coincides with critical early season planting in the Northern Hemisphere and threatens to reduce crop yield and boost food prices worldwide.
It is way more significant, it being the global shipping business, is way more significant to people's lives than I think people realize. Oil, natural gas, fertilizer, I think would be those most immediately directly affected by what's happening in the Gulf. The additional cost for the ship operators to go the long way round gets passed on to the consumer eventually.
Already hitting consumers in the wallet, the price of a gallon of gas in the U.S. has surged by roughly 60 cents a gallon since the war began. On top of the economic toll, the U.S.-Israeli war has now engulfed Lebanon in an attempt to rout out Iran-backed Hezbollah. Hundreds of people have been killed in Israel's intensified strikes, including a beloved Maronite priest. Father Pierre Al-Rahi was killed in an Israeli strike on Monday. He refused to leave his parishioners behind, assisting the injured until the moment of his death. Bishops, priests, and laity gathered on Wednesday for Father Al-Rahi's funeral. Mourners carried his coffin to St. George Parish, the community he served for 5 years. Lebanon's Christian villagers gained widespread attention for choosing to remain in their homes despite the escalating conflict. On Wednesday, Pope Leo XIV used his general audience to express his closeness to the Lebanese people and called Father Al-Rahi a true shepherd who remained with his flock to the end.
May the Lord grant that his bloodshed be a seed of peace for beloved Lebanon. Dear brothers and sisters, let us continue to pray for peace in Iran and throughout the Middle East, especially for many civilian victims, including many innocent children.
That same day, the Holy Father met privately with the Archbishop of Tehran, Cardinal Dominique Machu. The Belgian-born prelate had to evacuate Iran after Italy ordered its embassy, where the archdiocese is headquartered, to close. For many of us, the war in Iran is a distant war. But as the conflict expands across the region, it's affecting more of our Christian brothers and sisters in the Middle East and becoming increasingly personal for more members of the faithful. Earlier this week, I sat down in our studio with Bishop Elias Zaidan. He's currently the chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on International Justice and Peace. But he is also a Maronite bishop born in Lebanon who today leads the eparchy of Our Lady of Lebanon of Los Angeles. Here are his insights as the war in Iran continues to rage on. Your Excellency, thank you for taking the time to come join us in studio today for this really important conversation. You know, first, here you are. You are from the Middle East. Today you are a U.S. bishop. What's your reaction to the fact that the U.S. is now at war with Iran?
None of us likes war to start with. You know, violence, wars, you know, the church never would advocate for anything like that. We always like to have peaceful talks and peaceful resolutions. And that's what the Pope has been saying. Violence, we had enough violence, we had enough of wars. Unfortunately, not everybody heeds and hears and take it to heart from that perspective.
Well, speaking of violence, there is evidence that suggests an explosion that killed more than 165 people, mostly children, at an Iranian girls' school was likely caused. caused by U.S. airstrikes. As of this interview, the United States has not yet taken responsibility. It has been the highest civilian death toll since the war began. How devastating is this incident?
It's always sad to hear anything like that. Any innocent life, even if one person, is always, we always consider human life is sacred. God gave us that gift, and God only can take it from us. That's the reason we have to honor and respect life at everyone, especially the innocent people, whatever they are.
Mm. We've heard concerns from leading Catholics that this very real war that is going on is being treated like a video game by the administration. The White House last week released a video that splices real visuals from the war going on with scenes from action movies, sports, video games. Many have been upset by this. What's your take on the criticisms that the administration is treating this war flippantly?
I think all of them taking it, you know, all sides. It's not just one side who's taken it as a video game, I think.
Hmm.
I think all of them looking at the lives and the matters in not the proper lenses of peace and love and care and compassion and the common good.
Hmm. That's such a profound point. Anytime there's an attack on life, that's not acknowledgement of the reality of human dignity. Our Holy Father in his Sunday Angelus expressed his concern that this conflict will spread to other countries, including in Lebanon. And the very next day it was confirmed that a Maronite priest in southern Lebanon, Father Pierre El-Rahi, was killed in a bombing. I want to express my condolences to the faithful in Lebanon. You are a Maronite bishop from Lebanon. Did you know Father El-Rahi personally, and your reaction when you heard this news and how the conflict is now expanding?
You know, I didn't know him personally. I know his bishop very well. I extended my condolences to his bishop. I've seen him on TV. I read about him, how attached to his community and to his parish, to his hometown as well. And he didn't want to leave, and he was giving them courage to leave. The way it happened, from what we know, unfortunately, militia came to the town. The town is mainly Maronite. It's all a Christian. Came to the... There is two, three houses on the side of the town, a little bit, not outside the center. And they threw, against Israel from that perspective. And this escalated the violence in that targeted. And out of concern for his parishion, he went to see them in their home. And that's what happened, the unfortunate situation as well. Today, our patriarch, earlier this week, our patriarch said, no more violence. You know, we denounce it's only the government has a responsibility to protect the people. Mm. We don't want any militia. We don't want any attack against Israel from Lebanon so that we won't get the attacks from Israel on Lebanon as well. So that we need to stop what we call the spiral of violence.
Absolutely.
And the cycle of violence. We need everyone to make the effort to stop violence.
I mean, on that note, what else are you hearing from the church in Lebanon? What is the safety level there?
You know, the people over there concerned from that perspective. They're concerned because there could be some, you know, armed people, non-government, they could come to that area and create problem. Mm-hmm. That's what we want, to make sure the government protects its own citizens.
Yeah. What is the sentiment among Maronite Catholics in Lebanon with the killing of the Ayatollah?
You know, if I want to be honest with you, Iran was not the angel Gabriel's or archangel Gabriel's or guardian angel or anything. It did also undermine the Lebanese government and the Lebanese as a country and as a nation. And definitely the Christians suffered because of that as well. Mm. Maybe not in that bombing, but the slow losses and persecution in some ways. From that perspective, there was sense of relief, but maybe we were hoping to be resolved in a different way, so that we don't get repercussions on that perspective. But not just Lebanon, even the Arab countries also getting repercussions and consequences as well. And we hope that situation will be resolved as early as possible. Because when you see Iranian coming to Lebanon to fight in Lebanon, we don't want that.
Right.
We didn't ask for that. You know, we don't want Lebanon to be used as a ground for violence. It's not our culture. We don't want it.
We've heard our Holy Father express that same concern that this very thing would happen. Finally, Your Excellency, you have such a powerful perspective right now, being from the Middle East and being someone who is advocating for global peace. Do you have any final thoughts for our viewers as this war continues on?
First, to pray for peace. Yeah. That's you know, and peace has to start within the heart. Mm. If we don't have peace within our hearts, we can never have peace outside. Starting within ourselves, let God's presence move us and guide us so that we could really enjoy lasting peace, the peace that is a gift from God in every way.
Amen to that. Bishop Zaidan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
God bless you. Thank you.
The war has led to a heightened threat environment in the U.S., and on Thursday, tragedy struck at a Detroit-area synagogue. That's when a gunman rammed his truck into Temple Israel Synagogue, drove down a hallway, and was fatally shot by security officers. His truck caught on fire, and thick smoke billowed from the building. No one else was seriously hurt, including the 140 children in the synagogue's early childhood center. The suspect was identified as a Lebanese-born U.S. citizen. Members of the Lebanese-American community say he had been devastated by the loss of several relatives who were killed by Israeli strikes on their Lebanese village 2 weeks ago. The FBI is calling the attack a targeted act of violence against the Jewish community. There is much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Next, a deep dive into the transgender movement in America. Is it dead? We talked to a famed Catholic psychiatrist who predicted its collapse. And we talked to a woman who lived as a man for years about her heartache along that journey and how her faith in Christ has saved her. We'll be right back. Within the past decade alone, the transgender issue ballooned into a national movement. Millions of dollars poured into lobbying for transgender advocacy, and support seemed to swell for the issue. But now, from public perception to court battles, it seems gender ideology no longer has the same grip on America as it once did. We examine how today the tide seems to be turning against transgender ideology.
Common sense is being restored. The law seems to be pointing in the right direction.
Andrea Picotti-Bayer, director of the Conscience Project and legal analyst for EWTN News, has long followed the legal battle over gender ideology. She notes much of the pushback against the transgender movement is playing out in lawsuits, several of them in our nation's highest court. Earlier this month, the U.S. Supreme Court sided with California parents against a state law that forbade school teachers and staff from telling the parents their children wanted to transition.
I think that we are going to see policies across the country that mimic this fall to the wayside, and blessed be God that they will. But we also will see continued development of this important role of parents in saving and shielding their children from the confusion of gender ideology.
The High Court is also examining a ban on so-called conversion therapy and the legality of state laws that ban biological males from competing in women's sports. Last month, in the first malpractice verdict of its kind, a New York jury awarded $2 million to a young woman who underwent gender transition surgeries as a teen. She said her doctors did not fully inform her and her parents of the risks of the procedures.
I really do hope it's just the beginning. And there are many other cases that are in the courts right now of young people and their families that were pressured by really unprofessional medical professionals.
Those lawsuits reflect a shift in public opinion on the transgender movement. A 2025 Pew Research poll found about 56% of U.S. adults favor laws that ban healthcare professionals from providing gender transition procedures for minors. 66% favor laws that require trans-identifying athletes to compete on teams that match their biological sex. Dr. Ryan Anderson, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center and author of When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment, points out more and more Americans are willing to speak out against gender ideology.
People are discovering the emperor has no clothes. They're discovering that this is unfair to female athletes. This violates the privacy of women. And most fundamentally, it's just unjust to the bodies and the minds of young people.
with this executive order, the war on women's sports is over.
President Donald Trump dedicated much of his 2024 campaign to the transgender issue, and shortly after returning to office, signed several executive orders against gender ideology, including stripping funding from hospitals that provide gender transition treatments for minors. Those actions and growing public outcry have led to several large hospitals announcing they will no longer provide the procedures for minors. And the American Medical Association and American Society of Plastic Surgeons have both walked back support on the treatments.
When many other people either went silent or went the wrong way, McHugh had both the courage and the intellect to tell the truth.
One of the leading medical voices on the transgender debate is Dr. Paul McHugh, who served as the head of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine from 1975 to 2001. In his role, he shuttered the hospital's gender identity clinic in 1979, the first of its kind to specialize in what was then called sex change surgeries. Throughout his accomplished and controversial career, he has reiterated his belief that transgender-identifying patients suffered from a psychological rather than a biological problem. Transgender ideology advocates, students, and many of his own colleagues disavowed much of his work, but he never shied away from the truth.
He was denounced. He was attacked. He was correct, and he's been vindicated. He's the hero of this story the first time it popped up in the 70s. He's the hero of this story when it came back in the past decade.
Many have called Dr. Paul McHugh a prophetic voice in the transgender debate. For decades, as top psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins University Hospital, he warned the transgender movement will ultimately collapse, especially when the lawsuits from detransitioners start coming. Now 94 years old, I sat down with Dr. McHugh in his Baltimore home to discuss his trailblazing research and the role his Catholic faith has played as well. Here is Dr. Paul McHugh on the record. Dr. McHugh, thank you so much for inviting us into your home. It is an honor to speak with you.
Well, that's nice of you to say, but you're very welcome.
It really is. You have been a leading psychiatrist with a career spanning decades, and you've made some bold moves in your career. In 1979, you decided to shut down Johns Hopkins Gender Identity Clinic, and I believe it was the first clinic to provide what was commonly called at the time sex change operations. What was behind that decision in 1979?
First of all, I thought that this was a very radical idea. And I was always concerned in psychiatry for the radical imaginative ideas that seemed to be controlling it for the middle of the century, primarily in the middle of the century with the Freudian enterprise. It turned out that when I arrived, there was already a member of our faculty that was deciding to follow up on these cases and to see in what way they were better or worse. Mm. And it turned out that although most of the patients at the time felt that they had done the right thing when they subjected themselves to the surgery, all of the issues that they said was going to be corrected, their difficulties in interpersonal relationships, their difficulties in their jobs, their difficulty with their families, which was the whole reason for doing it, they were not better. They didn't improve.
So to be clear, shutting down that clinic, it was not driven by ideology. It was driven by the evidence.
By the evidence, yes. We had evidence there that the patients really weren't any better. And it was just about, you know, we'd been doing it for about 10 years. And so we had sufficient number to say that they were not benefiting.
And that was in 1979. What have you observed from your area of expertise, you know, on the so-called transgender movement from 1979 until now in 2026? Have you been surprised by the momentum that it picked up?
I was astonished by it. Because it didn't seem to me that we were doing anything terribly radical. But gradually the idea became that somehow or another we were denying these people their honest sex. And I kept saying, look, we're two things here. We have the facts of the body, and we got the ideas of the patient. And I thought that was one of the kinds of things where psychiatry has gone wrong in the past and could go wrong again. Mm-hmm. Imagining things rather than knowing things.
You talked about how extreme and dramatic of a procedure these transgender operations are and how the surgeries provide little change to psychological health after surgery. You don't support it for adults or children, but can you talk a little bit about the psychiatric impact specifically on children who undergo these operations or any so-called gender-affirming care?
Well, I think we don't know enough about it because we're not spending enough time studying them. I wanted more and more study so that we could understand how this idea had taken such a firm hold on them. To tell you the truth, I even now arguing about it, I say, you know, why are we still arguing about this? It's so obviously a mistake.
And there really is an impact on children who take puberty suppressors.
Oh, yes. The whole idea of doing this to children to slow down and presumably get them to think more about what they're experiencing has been a track towards, in fact, persuading them that and has not been a good idea. I've, after all, seen a lot of young people taking on, and they're very susceptible, especially young girls, to being persuaded that there are some aspects of themselves and their body that needs correction. I mean, it's really the foundation of anorexia nervosa and things of that sort.
Well, and you have stated publicly multiple times over the years that you thought it would be lawsuits that ultimately are what take down surgeries for minors. Well, 1 month ago, in a legal first, the first malpractice verdict about transgender surgeries providers, a jury in New York awarded a woman $2 million in damages for a double mastectomy she received as a teenager that she says has left her disfigured. She accused both her psychologist and her plastic surgeon of failing to obtain adequate consent about the risks before she agreed to the procedure. Dr. McHugh, the first malpractice suit now, is this the end of transgender surgeries for minors?
Well, I'm not sure. I think it should be, but there are going to be many more lawsuits coming down the pike now. As I predicted it would come. This is one of the problems with psychiatric inventions that often doesn't get sorted out in the clinic. It gets sorted out in the law. $2 million is a small thing. Mm. It's going to be a lot higher as more and more people come to realize, and they're going to be mostly women in their, mid-20s, they suddenly find themselves with 5 o'clock shadow and long voices and mutilated. And they're going to come and say to their parents, why did you let them do this to me? And they say, well, the doctors told us that you'd perhaps commit suicide if we didn't do this. And I said, well, you know, you should have held on and at least let me grow up to decide myself as an adult. And parents say, well, we were doing the best we could, given that you were transgender. Well, you see, I'm not transgender. And they go back to the doctors, and the doctors will say, well, we couldn't tell you then that we couldn't be sure who would transition happily and who would trans. Mm-hmm. And that'll be an amazing event when that happens, so suddenly that the doctors themselves, it turns out, were uncertain.
And these financial repercussions of the lawsuits.
Yeah, they're going to be big, I'm afraid. And to some extent, you have to remember, all of these people thought they were doing the right thing. They weren't people who were trying to do something wrong. They were trying to do the right thing. It's just they let their imagination carry them along rather than observing the facts.
So what do you say to critics who maybe discredit your work because they'll say, oh, well, he's just making these claims because he's Catholic? They discredit your work because of your faith. What's your response to those people?
Well, I first of all, I say I am Catholic, and I can't tell in what way my faith influences any of the things they do. I'm sure that it's important in everything I do, so I can't deny that it may play a role. Like I was able to say, look, I'm the Henry Phipps Professor of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins. If I can't ask these questions and listen for their answer or offer my suggestions as to what the answers are so far, who can? We're just going to... This is America, for crying out loud.
And looking back at this career that you've had, what do you want your legacy to be?
Well, I don't know about what my legacy is. I want people to think, though, that, you know, as I always say, I want them to think that I was part of my times and that I didn't shy away from the things that occupied the attention of my fellow Americans. You know, I think it's really important to see that the role you have calls for certain kinds of courage. And if you don't have that, you shouldn't have that role. And I had some adventures. And it turns out I was right about a lot of things. That's the fun part.
Last question, 94 years old. Any plans to retire?
No, I'm not retiring yet. I'm going to see if I can't go a bit further. God got me this far. Maybe he'll carry me on another while. I've got wonderful grandchildren I want to see more of and see how they flourish. Anyway.
Dr. Paul McHugh, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Dr. McHugh made clear these were his opinions and not those of Johns Hopkins University, which today is home to the Paul McHugh Program for Human Flourishing. You can watch more of my interview with Dr. McHugh on his concerns about gender transition, specifically for youth, and more on how his Catholic faith has formed him. Just go to EWTNnews.com/watch. The Catholic Church, in her wisdom, recognizes every human person is created in the image and likeness of God, male or female, and that we should not disorder or reject our undeniable biological reality. The 2024 Vatican document Infinitas Dignita, or Infinite Dignity, states, "We are called to protect our humanity, and this means, in the first place, accepting it and respecting it as it was created. It follows that any sex change intervention, as a rule, risks threatening the unique dignity the person has received from the moment of conception." While statistics and studies do reveal some of the harm caused by gender transition surgeries, there is nothing more powerful than hearing firsthand from people who have personally detransitioned, people who carry the permanent scars and side effects from transgender ideology and who are now speaking out against it. Our next guest has one such powerful story. Jessica Rose identified as a trans man for about 7 years. During that time, she went by the name Aiden, took testosterone, and underwent a double mastectomy. She said she somehow felt that changing her body and identity would erase the pain and trauma from her childhood. After years as living as a man, she fell into deep despair and attempted to take her own life, but survived. Months later, her boss at work shared the gospel with her, setting her on a new path of life in Christ. She has since stopped taking hormone treatments and has returned to living in her true identity as a woman, and shares her testimony with others today. And joining us now to share her thoughts on the trajectory of the transgender movement today with insights from her own story is Jessica Rose. Jessica, thank you for joining us and for being willing to share your story. I just want to say I only scratched the surface of sharing your journey, and I encourage our viewers to watch your full interviews on The Lila Rose Show and on Kim Zember's Here I Am Stories podcast, where they can hear more. But Jessica, I understand in your journey, you met only one time with a psychologist before beginning so-called gender-affirming care, before you began taking testosterone injections. What was that one meeting with a psychologist like?
It was brief. One, let me just say thank you for having me. But it was a brief meeting. It was a, why are you here? I believe I'm supposed to be a boy. Okay, let's have you meet with an endocrinologist. Wow.
What do you think the true psychiatric care was that you really needed in that moment?
I needed somebody to ask me why. Yeah. I needed somebody to figure out, where did this all begin? In the community of pride, we say, I was born this way. Mm-hmm. And we know we are not born this mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. But we don't want to admit something led us this way. We don't want to admit the trauma that might have led this way. We don't want to give power to molestation or anything, but real pain has led us to want to protect ourselves the way that we did, and that have led us to want to run away from who we were created to be.
You needed someone to walk with you in your suffering. Jessica, what's your reaction to Dr. McHugh's findings that transgender surgeries provide little change to psychological health after surgery? Do those findings match with your personal experience?
Oh, completely. Mm-hmm. I think I felt so seen.
Wow.
I believe that the outer experience that transitioning does for someone gives them a thrill. It did for me. We saw these pictures of the beard. We saw these pictures of what I look like. That's what I wanted. And yet it didn't actually fulfill me. I just looked good, but I was still the broken 12-year-old girl.
Jessica, and you were
and
so young.
It didn't fix anything.
You were young. I mean, I think you were only 21 years old when you began transitioning. Knowing what you know now, what's your reaction to the fact that there are children younger than that beginning those same gender transitioning treatments?
Yeah, Catherine, I believe if I was grown, right, everyone says at 21, you're an adult. You can make these decisions for yourself. You can go buy cigarettes now. You can have tattoos. You can do so many things at 21. So at 21, I thought I was grown enough to make this decision, to alter my body, to get these surgeries, to fill myself with testosterone. And knowing that the deeper wounds were mental, it did nothing. Mm-hmm. I've seen as young as 6 to 9 years old that parents are allowing their children to transition and begin hormone blockers. My heart breaks because I was wrong at 21 years old. How much more is this 6 to 9-year-old wrong about what they want? We love to say the frontal lobe isn't even developed. And it's really not as a cliche to throw at somebody. But the reality is they do not know things. They are still so young. They may not be aware of the factors that are contributing. They, you know, when we have this inner body experience, I want this, I like this, I think this, this is what I believe. But we are so scared to bring the gospel into the home, to speak true identity to the youth. No, God did not make a mistake with you. You have these feelings. Let's talk about it. Nobody wanted to discuss it with me. And now I'm an advocate for conversation, for relationship building. A mother and a father should be able to speak to their 6 to 9-year-old and say, there's nothing wrong with you. But what is making you feel like there is something wrong with you? Not invalidating, but trying to understand what this 6-year-old is believing about themselves to want to change everything about themselves. It's deeper.
It is. Jessica, for someone who may be watching, what is your message to a young person who may be grappling with gender identity and who truly believes that changing their body may bring them happiness?
I say, God did not make a mistake with you. You may be mad at God. You may be hurt by God. You may be upset with God. But I promise he did not make a mistake with you. There are people who are willing to walk with you through whatever you are believing about yourself. There are people who are kind and gracious who will listen to your pain and your trauma. Covering yourself with masculinity or femininity in the wrong context will not heal you. Surgeries do not heal you. Hormones don't heal you. God does. Our true living God heals you. He meets you in your pain. He meets you in your sorrow. Don't be scared to give him a chance. Don't be scared to allow him to reveal himself to you. You've made everything about yourself. You've tried everything your way. I pray and I plead with you to give God a chance for him to love you, because nothing else will love you the way that he loves you. Nothing else will fill you the way that he fills you. I learned this the hard way. My brothers and sisters, don't mutilate your body and regret it later, because you will.
Jessica, your vulnerability is so courageous. I am so grateful to you for sharing your story, for the generosity of your hard-earned wisdom in this. And I just pray that the Lord continues to just love on you and heal you and use you for his glory. Jessica Rose, thank you so much for joining us.
That's great.
News headlines are next in the Week in Review. There is movement on multiple fronts this week in the Jeffrey Epstein investigation. Details of that top the Week in Review. Epstein's longtime accountant and executor of his estate was called to testify under oath on Capitol Hill before the House Oversight Committee. Richard Kahn was Epstein's accountant for years. He told lawmakers he had not personally seen evidence of Epstein's sexual abuse, but provided a fuller picture of how Epstein acquired his wealth, which at one point was over $750 million, and how he spent it at his various properties. Kahn is mentioned more than 50,000 times in the Epstein files. As executor of his estate, Kahn also managed payouts of more than $121 million from the Epstein's Victims Compensation Fund to more than 135 survivors. Also this week, the New Mexico Department of Justice launched a search at a sprawling property Epstein used to own, known at the time as Zorro Ranch. Some Epstein victims say they were abused and trafficked at the remote and isolated estate near Santa Fe. The property has changed hands since Epstein's death in 2019, and evidence has likely been lost. But recent Epstein file mentions have spurred state authorities to open a criminal inquiry. The alleged scale of abuse in the Epstein case has shocked the world. EWTN News in Depth talked exclusively with a New Mexico rancher whose family sold Zorro Ranch to Epstein. Here's reporter Mark Irons.
The apparent first-time search of Jeffrey Epstein's Zorro Ranch in New Mexico comes 7 years after the death of the convicted sex offender who was charged with trafficking underage girls and, according to allegations, committed crimes here decades ago.
It's definitely too little too late.
A day before the New Mexico Department of Justice began the search, just outside the property, New Mexico resident Amanda Sisko joined other protesters alongside family members of Epstein accuser Virginia Giuffre, demanding justice for victims.
It feels like girls and women aren't believed.
A former worker at Zorro Ranch provided EWTN News in Depth with these pictures taken in 2003 of the outside and inside of the property. And now, in an exclusive interview, we're learning more about Epstein's time here from a member of the family that sold him the ranch.
He fooled a lot of people. He was powerful. He gave money to a lot of politicians.
Jerry King, a rancher and one-time political appointee as assistant land commissioner, is the nephew of Bruce King, the former governor of New Mexico who owned this ranch 30 miles south of Santa Fe before selling it to Epstein in the early 90s.
I never went up to the ranch once they purchased it.
King, who says he never met Epstein and claims he avoided conflicts of interest during his time at the land office, did call himself a friend of former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson.
When I would see him every once in a while, he would ask me, he says, you been out to Epstein's? That's your guys' ranch, you know, and it was sort of tongue in cheek.
Richardson received campaign donations from Epstein, and in a deposition, Virginia Giuffre alleged he was one of the men she was directed to have sexual encounters with. In a response, he said he'd never met her and denied any wrongdoing. Richardson passed away in 2023. He hasn't been charged with any crime related to Epstein. Neither has anyone in the King family. Jerry says he'd hear about parties or famous people at Zorro Ranch, but with a number of rich people owning ranches in the area, that wasn't uncommon. His cousin Gary King, the former Attorney General of New Mexico, who also ran for governor, claimed in one news report that he was unaware he had chartered Epstein's plane during a campaign flight in 2014, despite Epstein file releases that indicate he might have known. Another document shows his campaign thanks Epstein in 2014 for his commitment to raise $50,000. Reportedly, both King and Richardson returned or donated campaign funds after Epstein's abuse came to light. Jerry's sister, Rhonda King, appears among the list of Epstein contacts seen here in documents released by the Department of Justice. Jerry says she assisted with logistics in the sale of Zorro Ranch. Rhonda and Gary could not be reached for comment. We asked Jerry if anyone in the King family was aware of Epstein's crimes.
Or knew about it or covered anything up to your knowledge?
No. No, I never heard of it. We're a close family. I mean, we all talk a lot. If somebody would have thought something, somebody probably would have said something.
EWTN News In Depth spoke with two former workers at Zorro Ranch. Both said photographs depicting nudity were openly displayed around the New Mexico mansion. One said they included girls. The other said they showed young women. Around the time Epstein was convicted in 2008 of sex crimes involving a minor in Florida, one worker said the photos were taken down.
We always should have done more. I think it is too late by a lot of measures.
Earlier this year, New Mexico Land Commissioner Stephanie Garcia Richard took on renewed concern when an anonymous email released after the passage of the Epstein Files Transparency Act included unsubstantiated claims about girls being strangled and buried on the grounds outside Zorro Ranch. Garcia Richard was among those calling to reopen the state investigation that briefly started, then stopped in 2019.
Even without support from the federal government, we should be digging into what occurred here, even at this late date.
Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
The current owner of the former Epstein Ranch is fully cooperating with law enforcement authorities. He says he plans to turn the property into a Christian retreat. Mark Irons continues to work on this story and will have more from Zorro Ranch in the weeks to come. The partial government shutdown continues with no end in sight in the standoff between Republicans and Democrats over the Department of Homeland Security and a demand from Democrats for federal immigration reform. That means several departments within DHS are not being funded, including TSA. And now, weeks without pay is hitting America's 50,000 airport screeners hard. At some airports, travelers have experienced hours-long waits to get through security when enough agents have not been available. TSA reports about 6% of its workforce has quit. Others have called in sick. Some airports have been more impacted than others. At Hobby Airport in Houston, some waits have been as long as 3 hours.
Started deep inside the garage and it circles around seven times before you even get to this part.
Obviously, it's spring break. You know, travel plans are getting delayed or canceled, and so you have children involved, which is very tough.
Many aviation officials have asked Congress to go ahead and fund TSA, even if ICE reforms are still in limbo. Travel advice for now is to get to the airport early. TSA staffing cannot be guaranteed as some workers are forced to divert to second jobs to pay their bills. Pope Leo XIV has appointed an apostolic nuncio to his home country. Archbishop Gabriele Caccia will be the Holy See's new representative in the United States. Born and raised in Milan, Caccia has served in several roles for the diplomatic service of the Holy See, most recently as the permanent observer of the Holy See to the United Nations. He said he receives this new role with both joy and trepidation, and that it will be a mission at the service of communion and peace. Caccia replaces Cardinal Christophe Pierre, who served as apostolic nuncio to the U.S. for a decade. Americans love Leo. According to a new survey from NBC News, Pope Leo XIV is one of the most popular public figures in his home country. Among 1,000 voters asked about Pope Leo, 42% said they felt very positive or somewhat positive. Only 8% said they felt very negative or somewhat negative about our pontiff. With a net rating of plus 34, Leo ranked well ahead of TV host Stephen Colbert, Vice President J.D. Vance, and President Donald Trump. Even babies have been caught up in the Pope Leo effect. The Holy Father often pauses his Wednesday Popemobile ride through St. Peter's to bless little children. But this week, he was stopped in his tracks when he saw a little baby dressed just like him, white zucchetto and all. A gleeful Pope Leo greeted and blessed his mini-me, little Juan Diego, who traveled all the way from El Salvador with his family for this special moment. Finally, as we close today, we preview a new documentary from EWTN News in Depth correspondent Colm Flynn on the state of the Catholic Church in Ireland. 3 years ago on this program, Colm reported on the decades-long decline in the Catholic faith there, exacerbated by the clergy sex abuse crisis. Now, Colm reexamines the faith landscape and says there are signs of hope as young people reinvigorate Catholic faith traditions. Here's an excerpt of Colm's upcoming documentary.
It's Wednesday evening in Galway City, and in the cathedral around 60 young people have gathered to sing, to pray, and to sit in silence for Eucharistic adoration. After adoration is over, the group gather in a room in the back of the cathedral, and in real Irish style, the tea and biscuits are in full supply, and it gives me an opportunity to talk to some of them about their faith.
When you listen to the news or you read the paper, you'd be led to believe that the church, especially among young people, is dead in Ireland. What say you?
I don't think it's true. From my own experience, I think a lot of people are more open to faith than they would have been before. I think there's like a void in people's lives, and I'll often tell people I go to Mass or I pray or I'm a Christian, and they're like kind of astounded, but they're always interested. And I think everybody kind of tries to hide their interest in faith and in God and all that. They just don't have the place to share it, you know what I mean?
What's it like being a young Catholic in Ireland today?
It's wonderful. You know, have a little look around tonight. You know, there's no one over the age of 35 here. And people are joyful and they are ready and willing to represent Christ, you know?
You go around the country, you see the fire in like certain pockets more so than others, but that fire is there and it's being lit throughout the country, and I think it's a great time to be a Catholic.
Ireland once had a practice rate of over 90%, but over the decades, that number has diminished to now around 30%. But the interesting aspect of the story is the recent increase in the number of young people expressing interest in the faith. There is anecdotal evidence from across Ireland that seems to suggest Gen Z, that's people in their teens and 20s, are starting to turn to Christianity, and to some degree, the Catholic Church. For example, more Bibles were sold last year in Ireland than in any year since 2013. This year, almost 130 people are preparing in the Archdiocese of Dublin to be baptized at Easter. And a new report published by the Irish Catholic Bishops' Conference showed an increase in young people practicing their faith in 2023 and 24.
The report, very interestingly, does point to some type of uptick, as they call it.
From Galway in the west to Cork in the south, and more signs of hope. In the Church of Saints Peter and Paul, they have restarted 24/7 Eucharistic adoration, which is mainly being attended by young people. Sheila Kelleher is the coordinator of the youth ministry with the Diocese of Cork and Ross.
People are looking for substance, and I know for me, like, you know, I grew up in a rural parish in near West Cork. It's not quite West Cork, but so I grew up and we would have gone to Mass every Sunday. I became an altar server for my local parish, the first girl actually in my parish to altar serve. And I did that for a number of years, but I didn't really see many other young people around me. So I think, you know, being given these opportunities, I suppose I came into my faith well, through altar serving, which then led a priest in my parish invited me to go to Lourdes as a young adult helper. And that really changed my life. I met my husband in Lourdes, and my faith just went deeper. I started working for the chaplaincy in UCC, and then that led to me working with the diocese as the youth ministry coordinator there for the last year.
Sheeta tells me that the number of young people coming to their youth projects has tripled since 2023. PJ Cronin is another young Catholic who comes here for weekly adoration.
There seems to be more of an openness than I've seen in recent years, and a lot of young men especially returning to the faith, which has given me a lot of hope.
Why is it, do you think, that in particular young men are coming back to the faith?
Good question. I suppose the way society has gone, there's been a kind of... men have kind of reverted into themselves because masculinity has come in under attack. You know, there's this narrative that anything you do at all that's masculine is toxic masculinity. And men really have found nowhere to go with that. They look around, and I believe as a Catholic, the truest answer of masculinity is Jesus Christ. And, you know, when that's presented to you, I don't think that can help but to change you. And I've seen so many people brought into the faith just because of that, just looking for responsibility, looking for meaning. And I think there's something about that model that just, it's so attractive. And, you know, even all the saints throughout history, and of course our Lord himself, you know, the servant leadership model of giving yourself for others, I think there's something about that that just calls to young men when it is presented to them fully. Because it's uncomfortable, but, you know, there's something about that that attracts people.
So they're attracted to the idea that the church is saying, look, this isn't going to be easy and this isn't going to be comfortable. This will be a challenge.
Because you're called to more. There's something in us that I don't think we seek comfort. Like Pope Benedict, you know, he said, we're made for greatness, not comfort. And I think there's something about that. You know, the paradox of the cross, the most beautiful thing you could ever look at, but also terrifying. You know, something that is uncomfortable, but it will make you grow, make you better than what you are. Then that calls to them.
Sunday morning mass in Cork, and the cathedral is busy, and those who are attending are mainly the older generation. However, you have some of the young people who are coming back as well. But what type of Catholic church are they coming back to? To find out, I sat down with Bishop Fintan Gavin.
I see a very vibrant, renewed church, a church much more of conviction, where people make a decision about being part of church.
When you say a church of conviction, what do you mean by that?
That, I suppose, if we look at the church in the past, had changed very quickly. It was very much, there was a culture there that supported it. People went, the expectation was people would be in church on a Sunday, people were part of it. I think today there's a very, very strong culture that doesn't support faith, so people have to make a decision around faith themselves. I think the church today is a much humbler church, and that we're leading from gospel values that are based on justice, peace, love, integrity. We've seen a great growth here in new communities coming to Ireland from other parts of the world. We had 14 young people who were received into the church or baptised here at our Easter Vigil last year from Ireland, but other parts of the world as well. And so you see those signs of renewal.
In Ireland, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
Colm's full documentary on the Catholic Church in Ireland will air on EWTN on Wednesday, March 18th at 6:30 p.m. Eastern. It will also be available online next week at EWTNnews.com/watch. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Until we see you again, God bless.